What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Weapons of mass destruction we wanted to find, but in the end, it was an international crime or something.
Oh my God. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Matt Hogan.
On this week's show, we're speaking with Seth Cutler, CEO of IANA. But first, we're talking about chatbots in cars and Chinese EVs landing in Canada, which is actually starting to happen. Mac, it's great to see you. We haven't seen each other in like a couple of weeks since you've been on the road. How's it going,
man? Yeah, good, man. Good to see you. Yeah, I was on the road in Barcelona, actually. And let's segue into the first thing I was going to talk about, which is the Volvo EX60. Now, I'm not allowed to talk about that or how it drives yet, so we'll maybe talk about that next week. But it was my first experience using this new thing that's coming to a lot of cars called conversational navigation powered by Google's Gemini AI. So it was pretty interesting experience.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear how that worked in a car because we've been hearing about this stuff. I actually do have some limited experience with it that I'll talk about too. But we should note, this is not a Volvo exclusive feature. The Gemini conversational navigation was also announced for the Mercedes CLA. It's coming to all the Mercedes that have that like latest generation MBUX system. They'll have that. It's coming to a bunch of Polestar and Volvo cars. They announced that not too long ago. Gemini is coming to 4 million GM vehicles. We talked about a couple weeks ago. 2022 model year and up, GM cars will get Gemini. Other Google built-in cars should get it as well.
Yep.
And this is also a thing that it's not only limited to Gemini, although it is that seems to be one of the best and most widespread applications of it. Like Grok in the Tesla will do some of this stuff as well. So it's kind of a trend that's happening across the industry.
For sure. And so to be clear, the basic idea, right, is that in addition to being like, you know, get me directions to X restaurant, you can talk to it conversationally. And I know, you know, we all know AI is kind of being shoved into every nook and cranny of everything. We've written some stories here about like AI is kind of coming for your car, whether you want it or not. A lot of companies are using it as a buzzword and a catch-all for, you know, trying to make a digital assistant that actually works. But this one is interesting because it's more about finding locations without having to be super specific or being super specific in a way that isn't going to really be solved with a Google search. So notably, it's also coming via Android Auto to pretty much everything. So if you have an Android phone, you can probably already use this feature. But in the EX60 and the Google built-in cars, in the Mercedes, all that stuff, it natively integrates with the car and the route planner, which is where I think it's kind of a game changer because it solves, to me, one of the main problems I have on EV road trips where I am looking for a charger, but I also need lunch, and I don't want a charger that's in the back of a Petco parking lot, but also...
Mac hates animals, everybody.
Absolutely, no. no, my dog Kickflip is my son. I love him, but... yeah, and so we'll be driving and looking for, actually a good example of that is we're going for a road trip and we need to stop and need to charge the car, but also my dog needs a walk, needs to get some energy out. And so you can do things like say, find me a over 350 kilowatt fast charger with a public park nearby where I can walk my dog. And that kind of thing, to do that, you know, sort of the normal way, we would look at all the charging stations and then zoom in on the map and look if we could see a public park within that area. And then we click on the park and, okay, it's actually a monument and not a place with a lot of grass or anything like that. And a lot of zoom in, zoom out, whatever.
And like you would realistically do that on your phone. You wouldn't do that in the car screen.
Right. So
you
would
take out your phone and you would be like, let me look for all this specific stuff.
Right. So I need, you know, my passenger, whoever it is, to handle that for me. Google, you know, handled that pretty instantaneously in the Volvo. So I was able to try that. But another big thing that we have run into is my fiance has celiac. So she can't eat gluten, which means that a lot of restaurants don't really work for us. So we're looking for a charging stop next to a restaurant with gluten-free menu options. The current way I do that is, or she does that if you're in passenger seat, is you look at all the charging stops along the route, then you zoom into all of them until you find one that's near restaurants. Then you go to the restaurants, but while you're in the navigation view on Google Maps, you can't also click on restaurants and go to menus. So you have to exit navigation once you find a cluster that you think looks good, click on the menus, search through. It's a nightmare. It takes a really long time. And then in the Volvo, I was just like, hey, find me a fast charging stop along my route that has good gluten-free menu options. And what's cool about it is not only does it instantly find that for you, but also it was like, hey, you know, here's a charging stop. It's a 350 kilowatt charger. And it's next to, you know, this place that's Lebanese and it, you know, that reviews say has good menu options. And then the conversational part, it's not just that it finds that, but then you can say, well, what on the menu is gluten-free? Because what if I'm not in the mood for X, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, these things are naturally gluten-free. This is listed as gluten-free, but always check with the server. You know, it gives you the classic warnings or whatever. But there's just a lot of, that's a specific thing to me, but there's just a lot of similar requests you can make that are really helpful. Like find me a charging stop with a bathroom. Or, you know, I'm going to actually have to stop and pull off earlier. Find me a 3-star hotel along the route with availability tonight and a swimming pool. And all of these things that are conversational, I think it's one of the first cases where I'm seeing an in-car AI thing that like makes intuitive sense to me. Because one thing we were talking about with the Volvo PR person is just that like that kind of feature of like finding restaurants with gluten-free options next to charging stations is not a feature that anyone is going to code specifically. There was never going to be a deterministic way to do that because it's just so niche. And so I don't know what your version of using this is, but I'm sure everyone listening to this has certain things they want near a charging stop or near a hotel or anything like that. And the ability to team navigation with context to say, I want this destination near this other thing or for this price. Or I could even ask like, hey, which of these two charging stations is cheaper and route me to the cheapest one. And it did that. And all of these things I was excited about when they pitched it. The first I heard about it was the Mercedes version of it. Mm-hmm. But as with all AI stuff, I was like, okay, this all sounds really cool. Is it going to work? And everything I threw at the car, it did it quickly. It did it well. And I was blown away by it.
Yeah, I think this is gonna be, I think this is like the best feature to come to cars in a long time. Like if you just think about like, what do you want to do in the car that is kind of complicated and kind of annoying and you want it to be easier? It's like, you're going places. You want to know where you're going. You want to know things about where you're going. You want to maybe change it along the way.
Yeah.
And this just makes that a lot easier. Like you can also do, I don't know if you tried this, but I think you can do like multi-step routes, you know, like before the voice assistants in these cars, it would be like, you could say, find me a gas station, or you could say, you know, route me home or route me to this address. It was always like one thing at a time. And then it wouldn't like remember. Now you can be like, hey, route me home and put a stop at a Starbucks on the way or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's just like a very natural way to navigate. I think the other thing that was really cool that I tried this in Android Auto. So it's like a little bit different, but it's the same concept. It's not as integrated with the car. It's more like just a layer, you know, on top. But I did things like, hey, like what are some, I think one of the cool parts is not knowing specifically where you want to go and asking things and learning things. So being like, what are some quick hikes near me?
Yeah.
And it like listed out a few options that it tells you about. It's like this one, you know, people say it has stunning city views and whatever. Yep. And this one, if you're looking for a little bit more of, you know, an ocean vibe, whatever.
Yeah, the Volvo head of partnerships guy was talking about driving into Barcelona and asking it like, hey, what are some like can't miss stops along my route of just like places that I should check out? And it was totally vague, right? And it was like, oh, hey, if you're driving past, you know, town of Seville or something, you should stop there for lunch. Or, you know, if I was driving up to visit you in the Bay Area and I was like, hey, you know, take me the scenic route, it's probably going to recommend that you go on Big Sur. And I think that's what AI is actually good at doing, right, is collecting sort of the consensus of like what is good. And it's not always the best at like, you know, finding the most nuanced version of all the facts or anything like that. But I found it's really helpful for things like when I like to go off-roading, but it's really hard to find trails that are like, it's a cool dirt trail, but also something I don't need a rock crawler for. And that's where I'll use like ChatGPT for a lot, is saying like, hey, you know, what's some stuff, you know, what are some good off-roading areas near San Diego? And it, you know, combs hundreds of forums and all that's collected, you know, herd knowledge, I like to call it, and finds it along the way. And like, that is what I need in the car. And I think it also is suited to AI's downsides, right? Which is like, sometimes it's not going to, you know, present the best option, or I might hallucinate something. But in these cases where you're just like, I'm looking for a cool stop, if it suggests something that like isn't cool, you'd just be like, no, I don't want to go there. Like, it's or you can ask for more information about it, which again, that follow-up question part is such a big part of it.
Yeah, like I asked it, another example, I was like talking about going to burger places, you know, along the way to my hike. And I was like, hey, I don't remember the name of the place, but I remember that it has this and this on the menu. I was like, they sell smash burgers and they have like a chicken burger, and it got it. It was like, oh, I think you're thinking of, it was like, I think you're thinking of this place. And I was like, that's totally it, which that's just really cool.
Yeah. And things like, find me like the best restaurant, or just things like find me something interesting, or the best burger place anywhere along my route. Yeah. And some of it still is gimmicky and not perfect, right? Of like, in addition to the conversational navigation with Gemini, there's now this like, let's talk function. And so you can say like the normal, hey, Google, hopefully nothing in my house is...
you just triggered like thousands of Google assistants around the country.
Hey, Google, give Inside EVs a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
How to lose listeners. Yeah.
Anyway, so I was hanging out with my friend Alexa. And so I say, Alexa, Siri, come here. Now I'm really asking for it. But anyway, so you can say, hey, Google, and that gets you into the normal interface. But then you can say, hey, G, I'm going to stop saying it now, and let's talk. And that gets you into the like conversational thing where it will ask you follow-up questions. It's basically like the ChatGPT voice app or something. And that's kind of neat if like, you know, we're driving around Spain and you pass a cool monument and like, what's that monument over to my right? And it explains what it is. And it's like, oh, it's about this guy. And you can say, oh, what'd that guy do? You know, what's going on there?
Did you try that with the location context like that? Like what's near me right now without telling it?
And I saw on the map what it was called and I asked about asked that. I need to try the contextual version of it. I wonder if it would work. But then like once you, so you can get like, I like when I'm driving past a city to be like, oh, you know, like how many people live here? What's the, you know, main industries or something, or you pass some interesting looking plant and you're like, what does that company do? And I think that's vaguely interesting if you're just like a person that likes to know about stuff. But pretty quickly, me and my drive partner, Billy Reebok from Motor Trend, just ended up basically having a long conversation with the AI where we were just gaslighting it and just hearing it constantly be like, you're completely correct. Just over and over, just being like, you're absolutely right. I was wrong to say this. So there's a limit to how much use it is. Like mostly it's having a conversation with something that has no real opinions but has a vague knowledge of everything. That's fine. I'm sure that will get better. I'm sure people will find uses for it, but I think you're right, the conversational navigation thing is probably the best thing to happen to in-car navigation since Google Maps in-car was added navigation to car. Yeah, pretty much. It's like we got navigation, then we got Google Maps, and now we have this layered on top of it. So I will say
like it wasn't perfect. There were times the main thing was like they still have issues with, you know, they don't always get the intention of what you're saying, right. I think. So, like, I was talking about hikes, and I was like, which one of these is the shortest?
Yeah.
And it was like, well, this one is the closest to you. And I was like, no. Which one is the shortest in duration or length of the hike, you know? And then it was like, oh, yeah, this one's 1.2 miles versus the other one.
Right.
So there's always going to be, I think, it's going to be a learning process where these things get better and better.
Yeah.
The other thing,
but that
was,
ability to correct yourself, though, is notable of just like, you couldn't get that information without looking at your phone before this. But yeah, I do think I kept trying to trick it. And to be clear, I also wasn't able to always verify, like I asked for charging stations with a bathroom and it sent me results. I didn't go there to confirm that the bathroom existed, you know? But fundamentally, I think I'm willing with AI, like research and writing and things like that. I'm not very tolerant of faults because I'm often frustrated at a machine making an error that a human wouldn't have made. But in this context, I'm like, well, I can't do this while driving without this is my only way to do it. So even if it's imperfect, I think it's already way better than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to accept a little
like,
bit of that.
I mean, I would also like to kind of interrogate it more and figure out how good the results are. But you're talking about Gemini pulling from Google Maps, you know, like you can see how like Google Maps knows this is like probably the best repository we have of where things are and what they are.
Right.
And like you can, I think you can trust that a little bit more than like a general, maybe ChatGPT search or something.
For sure.
The last thing I'll say
from
is
the
like,
reviews too.
Yeah. Is, maybe I was in the maybe the Android Auto is a little bit different. Maybe it was in the talk function, but I found it like insanely chatty to a degree that was annoying. Like I would ask it to route somewhere and it would be like, is there anything else I can do for you? Maybe along the way, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, just do what I'm asking and don't ask follow-ups. Like how hard is that?
That is part of it too. Even in the not let's talk mode, which I don't know if there's a distinction within Android Auto. And I was talking to the head of Volvo's partnerships on this who worked with Google on it. And he was like, yeah, I think that that distinction is going to be tough for consumers to understand if like that there's two separate models that are accessed through this little key phrase. But yeah, it would be like, I would ask for options with gluten-free, you know, menu items. And then it would say, okay, these are your couple options. Like, would you like me to look into whether or not, like it would suggest what I do next with it. I was like, I wish there was an ability to say, just answer the question and then move on. I will say, though, more than another thing that I quickly learned to do with it, which you can't do with other voice assistants, but in the AI mode, you can absolutely do and should do, just interrupt it. Don't let it keep talking. Or just like, just literally be like, done, shut up. And it picks it up pretty quickly. But yeah, I hope they continue tuning that because it is one of those things where it keeps trying to suggest like, hey, by the way, I can also do this. And I'm like, just let me ask you what I need you to do. And I hope I also think one thing I would love in all AI models, especially anything over voice, when you talk to, and you're in let's talk mode and you're talking to Gemini, it always starts with, that's actually a great question, or you're absolutely right, do this. And I was like, can I have a checkbox for impolite mode where it just like ignores the formalities, stops pretending it's a person? Because I find that so irritating that it just
like,
starts with like, by the way,
it's
you're
like
really
many
cool.
Many people are gluten-free.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually
like,
really important. Thanks for looking into that. Let me check. And you're just like, you've already generated the actual response. Like, I would think it's vamping for time, but it's not. It's just that it knows that it just needs to keep flattering you. But yeah, there was it was a lot of fun playing with the Let's Talk model, but only when you were really bored and just wanted to goof with it. Because, you know, there's only so much like, that's a great point I can take in a given time before I just want to throw
but
up.
People get bored in the car. Like maybe this is a thing that people will use. Like
driving can
be boring.
So much fun with just making it do the most insane stuff. Like describe why the Iraq war was a bad idea in rhyming iambic pentameter. And it was like weapons of mass destruction we wanted to find, but in the end it was an international crime or something.
Oh my God.
It was an interesting experience for sure.
Okay. Before we get too far off the rails, we're moving on.
Good idea.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is another big piece of news from the last couple of weeks. Chinese EVs are starting to land in Canada. As a refresher, Canada recently announced it would drop its 100% tariff on Chinese cars to 6.1%, but only for a small quota of the first 49,000 cars imported annually. And after that, you could still import, but they'd be taxed at the higher rate. And we're starting to see the results of that. So last week, Geely said that it was the first Chinese automaker to export cars to Canada. It sent 18 Lotus Eletras. And then there was this YouTuber. There have been people spotting a few of these cars just parked in parking lots in Canada. So this YouTuber spotted a Jayco J5, an Omoda 9, and an Exelantis ES all next to each other in a Toronto parking lot. We spec like maybe these are there for testing. This is probably not, you know, customer or cars or anything.
Yeah.
But they're starting to kind of lay the groundwork for bringing these cars into Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting too that they're coming in, but also under 50,000 cars is not a lot. It's, yeah. You know, they sold like 1.8, 1.9 million cars in Canada last year overall. So it's not going to be like they're going to take over the Canadian market anytime soon. But it is really interesting to see that, especially knowing they're already in Mexico, right? And so to like, you can feel this pressure of they're getting closer to getting into the US. But I'm interested to see how this develops. I mean, do you have any info sort of on where, how open to these Canadians are? Where are we looking at there?
Yeah, so Canadians are open to them, maybe slightly more so than Americans. This was a recent survey from Auto Pacific. They found that 55% of Canadians would consider a Chinese EV if they were sold there. 20% said, no, I would not. In the US, it's just a little bit skewed more toward the no side. It's 51% of Americans would consider a Chinese car if it was sold here. 23% wouldn't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, over half is like a lot of people. I would be curious to see how these questions were phrased. Like,
yeah,
open to a car is, it could mean a lot of things.
Right. Would consider.
Or would consider.
Right. That's a tough one in all of like, whenever I get data on like how many Americans are like considering EVs, and it's like, well, like 42% would, I made that number up, would consider. And it's like, I would consider it a lot of things, but what am I going to buy? And I think, especially with cars, there's that thing of if 55% would consider, but when it comes down to drop 30, 40 grand, like what does that number actually look like? And obviously it's not like 50% of Canadians are going to be purchasing Chinese cars, right? Because the market cannot support that just in terms of how many can come in without tariffs. But also it's important to look at whether these numbers are 55% of new car shoppers versus 55% of Canadians overall. Because generally, shoppers for cars skew way older and way richer than average. And I would hazard a guess that, especially in the US, like the people who are saying they would consider, I would imagine skew younger just by the people I've talked to that mm-hmm. seem most interested in it. But I think it's pretty clear there's like in Canada, in the US, and most countries that don't have them, like there's awareness that Chinese EVs are pretty advanced and sophisticated and well-priced. There's some desire for that because the domestic EV market isn't there. But I think, you know, the roadblocks for them ever getting here are still so bipartisan and so large of like, even though people are open to it, the car companies are not in a great position because of their own mistakes and also because of regulatory whiplash. And I don't think there's any real appetite on either side of the political aisle to open the floodgates anytime soon. But I think this could be an interesting test case, especially that they're doing it cautiously. And I'm curious to see too, is that
does that quota go up over time? Is it holding steady? Like, is it going to be this year just a tiny trial? See how it affects the market. Keep expanding. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. One note quickly. So that study, yes, it is about people intending to buy a new vehicle in the next few years. So that's something.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the argument for this being a big, you know, for this having a big impact on the U.S. is like it will make North American consumers maybe, you know, give them more familiarity with these Chinese cars. Like if you're in Detroit or Buffalo or whatever, somewhere close to the Canadian border, like you might start to see these JCOs and whatever. And like maybe that influences how you think about Chinese cars or the C1s you really like. I don't know how much we've already been seeing that in Mexico. Like there are tons of Chinese cars in Mexico, which means
there are
BYD Sharks or whatever in El Paso and in San Diego, you know, going over the border. I'd be curious to know if like people in those places feel differently or desire those cars.
Good question.
Because that's going to be way more of an impact than the 49,000 in Canada, of which probably some high number is probably just going to be Teslas coming from China,
right?
Which people already know about.
Yeah, and then there's also and maybe won't know that they're made in China even, right? And certainly won't notice when they drive by that they're made in China. But I think there's also an interesting, weird incentive here where when there are so few cars able to come in, you know, with 49,000 units spread across all of the manufacturers, which many, many Chinese manufacturers have too much capacity they're trying to export. There's Tesla that's going to already have an established network to sell them through, so they're going to take up a lot of the space. And so I'm curious how that affects the dynamics of what's actually offered there, because I think what most people want from Chinese EVs is the fact that they're cheaper. You know, they're impressed by the technology, but I think the big thing that I hear from normal people is just like, oh my God, I've heard these Chinese EVs are so cheap and still really good. And it's interesting because if you can only sell 10,000 cars, right, for let's say your Chery or one of their subsidiaries, well, you don't really want to go through the trouble of building up a whole network to sell them if you're selling $10,000 cars on razor thin margins. So structurally, you would want to sell your most profitable, highest margin stuff. But also, if you want to establish a long-term, you know, reputation as a leader on cost, you want to offer the cheap stuff. So I'm really curious what products end up actually getting offered. Are they going to try to profit maximize in the short term? Or are they going to try to just accept that they're not going to make any money, but build a customer base for the future?
Profit maxing. It's the new rage in business.
Yes. Yeah. For the first time ever. Shareholder maxing.
No, I think the affordability thing is a big point, because I think that's a thing that could turn the needle for these cars, right? Is like people seeing them in Canada and being like, oh wait, that costs, you know, $25,000.
Right.
We have a little bit of a sense of this already. Tesla started selling a Model 3 rear wheel drive in Canada for way cheaper than it was before.
Yeah.
The equivalent of about $29,000 US versus in the US, it's like over 40,000.
Yeah.
We don't know necessarily that
that's the premium model, right?
Right. Premium. Yeah. We don't know necessarily that this is a China made car, although that's kind of what the timing and everything and the pricing points to. If you bring in a car that's way cheaper just after the tariffs left.
Yep.
So this kind of gives a taste of how cheap potentially these cars can be. I think the backlash in the US is just like, you cannot overstate that, right? Maybe consumers are open to it. Lawmakers, this is the only thing that unites Republicans and Democrats, is like not wanting Chinese cars in America.
Right. People forgot that the 100% tariff on Chinese cars is a Biden era tariff, back before everything had tariffs on everything, like before tariffs were a fundamental tool of our policy.
Yeah.
Like that.
And as was the tech ban, right?
Right.
The ban on connectivity tech on Chinese connected vehicles, on Chinese driver assistance technology. And this week, some members of Congress introduced a new bill to basically codify that, right? Like that's a rule that the administration set. Now there's an effort from Congress to put that into law, to put these bans on the Chinese connected vehicle tech and the autonomous tech and make that a part of U.S. law. So we'll see if that passes. But in general, this the whole like Chinese EVs are coming thing, it's the politicians do not want that, and neither does the auto industry.
No, there's a strategic angle to it where like having advanced manufacturing in your country is something that politicians care about, obviously from a commercial aspect, but there's a security and global strategy angle of like it's important to have industries that can build complex products, and we have so hollowed that out here. And the auto industry is one of the few things that is, I mean, a lot of the cars sold here are made here, right? And obviously that's a huge priority of this administration. So I don't think, and then the connected car ban, and then factor all of that in, right? And sure, in theory, you could have Canadian factories for Chinese car companies. But then if you're not using the Chinese battery supply chain, and you, or you are, but you have to ship it across the world, and then you're using Canadian labor rates and Canadian, you know, infrastructure costs and your own Canadian supply chain for a lot of things. And then you have to develop an entirely separate software stack, completely different to what's available in China. At some point, like the cost advantage just gets chiseled away to it's like, well, is it still going to be? And also we have to remember that even without those barriers, a major reason they want to keep exporting cars is because they're not making money on them in China anymore. And so they need to drive profit outside this place. So when we look at like, oh my God, you know, Chinese EVs are cheap and therefore I want a BYD Shark pickup truck because it would be way cheaper and cooler than a Tacoma. And then you go look at like, look at BYD Mexico's website. The BYD Shark is not a significantly, or I don't even think it's at all cheaper than a Tacoma or the local competition or things from here. So it's not that they're always going to be positioned as these hyper budget vehicles, or they will offer cheaper cars, but they'll be cheaper cars in the context of smaller things like, you know, a BYD Dolphin Surf or something like that, also known as the Seagull, which regardless of trade barriers, right? Like that's just not the type of car Americans tend to aspire to. So I don't think, I agree with you. I don't think there is any near-term likelihood of the Chinese cars coming in large volumes and having a disruptive effect on our market directly. But also long-term, I don't think it matters because if you're losing across the globe, you're going to lose scale. And when you lose scale, you're not going to be able to compete either way. And even if U.S. automakers are content to mainly hang out in the U.S. forever and not expand globally again, as they used to have much more ambitions for, even in the U.S. market, they have to compete with German car companies that are already competing with Chinese car companies in their home markets. And they're going to have to compete with Korean and Japanese companies that want a piece of the Chinese market. And at the end of the day, the most efficient form of an automaker is an automaker that can compete in all of these places because they have a product that's among the best in the world. And Tesla is a perfect example of that, right? Like Tesla has to learn how to make cars cheaper and build their vertical supply chains because Tesla needs to continue winning in China. And they're struggling with that. But it doesn't matter if BYD can't come here, if you still have to compete with a Tesla that is competing with BYD and you still have to compete with a VW that's competing with BYD, then you're a little bit insulated. But in the long term, if you can't compete, you're not going to be able to win.
Totally. If you are a listener in Canada and you buy or see one of these Chinese cars, let us know. Drop us an email. Now, here is my conversation with Seth Cutler, the CEO of IANA. If you talk to potential EV buyers, one complaint comes up again and again. Public charging just isn't good enough yet. It's inconsistent, sometimes it's frustrating, and it's still a barrier for many people who are otherwise sold on EVs. At the same time, public fast charging is getting better than ever, and even as EV sales slow down, charging companies aren't taking their foot off the accelerator. Today, we're speaking with someone who's deeply familiar with the latest in EV charging and whose company is trying to fix a lot of those sticking points. Seth Cutler is the CEO of Ayana, a charging company backed by 8 automakers. Seth, welcome to the Plugged In podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Looking forward to that conversation today. It's going to be great.
Yeah. So give us like the basics. The concept of Ayana was announced a few years ago. Your first rechargery opened for business early last year. Give us like the lay of the land. Like, where is Ayana right now in terms of deployment, in terms of what you're trying to do and where you're trying to go?
Yeah, it's great. So, I mean, the company was first announced back in July of 2023, which seems like a long time ago, but the company didn't actually start until February of 2024. So, you know, employee number one, building a company, building an org, and then building a product, which are our locations. And, you know, we soft launched our first site in December of 2024. So if you think about the arc that we're on, it's taken us time to get the company started. But the sites really haven't been on for that long. In fact, we really weren't in full swing operation until February of 2024. So really a year ago, or a little over a year ago. And so today we have a national footprint. We're about 110 sites live right now across the United States. I think we're in about 36 states now across the US. And we have another, you know, 50 plus sites that are actually in construction now, with about 400 more that are contracted, working their way through permitting and making their way into construction. So, you know, we've been making a lot of progress to build scale. I'm sure we're going to talk about more here, right? But the stuff we're building also has a different level of customer experience, with canopies and restrooms we're building and actual driver lounges. So it's about what we call quality and scale and really changing the customer experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how does that 110 stations now, 50 in the pipeline, how does that compare to like what you envisioned? Is that basically on track?
Yeah, you know, we had made an announcement that we were trying to get to 1,000 bays within our first year of operation, and yeah, I think we got just about there within a few weeks of it. So we're tracking to where we want to be. You know, right now we're a network in across the United States. You know, we did a recent road trip for spring break from Raleigh, where our headquarters is, down to Orlando with the family, and we did it all on Ayana. You know, I drive a Tesla. My wife drives a Tesla. I drive a BMW, and we took the Tesla down. And you know, normally we do it on supercharger. This time we did it just on Ayana rechargeries, and it was a great experience. So we're a network today, and we see that, you know, talking with drivers and customers, but our goal is to become the network, right? Where people say, hey, that I use Ayana for all of my travel, whether it's, you know, weekend corridors or in the city. And that's really what we're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have you found that, you mentioned the canopies, the, you know, rest kind of stop model that you guys are following, like bringing a little bit more to the EV charging experience than you historically had when you're like charging behind a Whole Foods or whatever with like nothing around you. Have you seen that EV driver, like are people responding well to that? Or do you think they're choosing Ayana because of, you know, oh, now I don't get rained on or whatever it is?
Yeah, I think it's part of our ethos, honestly, right? In terms of the brand that we built, of there's really three things that we've been trying to do, right? One is, we want to make sure charging works. And I think that's been an issue in the country, is that, you know, Tesla's done a good job of this, but outside of that, it's been very difficult saying, hey, I can rely on a singular network that I know it's going to work every single time. And that's really kind of the foundation of what we're trying to build. That's number one. Number two is, we're really trying to change that customer experience, right? You say, hey, when I go to an Ayana rechargery, what does that mean, right? So, hey, 100% of our sites have trash cans and squeegees, and you know, 35% of our sites have canopies today. We put them in where we can. We're trying to make sure there's always amenities, where, you know, wherever possible. All of our sites have lighting. We've gone back and added lighting to our sites, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the second pillar, right? Really thinking about the overall experience you have at the location beyond just the charging piece. And then the third one is really on the value, right? And so we've been very purposeful and mindful about how we set price to make sure that we're giving the best value in the marketplace today. To remove the barriers for folks to say, hey, I don't want to move to electrification, either from a cost standpoint or from a tech standpoint. So those are really the three things that we think about, is, you know, charging reliability, customer experience, and then best value in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about number one, because that's the one that's like, you know, in my intro, I talked about how reliability, like people have this impression that charging kind of sucks sometimes. And that has that doesn't come from nowhere, right? Like over time, historically especially, you'd pull up to chargers and they'd be broken, or the payment just wouldn't go through. There were these issues that were real sticking points. What were kind of the big sources of that, and how are you trying to address that in your deployments?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was on a panel recently, and this came up around this thing, right? And for me, I kind of boil it down to one word that's really core to how we run the business here, which is accountability. And I think in the industry today, to your point, you know, there's payment providers, there's vehicles, there's chargers, there's the grid, there's maintenance providers, there's labor involved, all the stuff that goes into it. And I think when you wrap your head around how you build an organization and a culture inside of a business that say, we're accountable for the solution for the driver, that yields different results. I think that's fundamentally how we try to run the business in terms of, you know, everything that we put out, we test first. If something goes down, we're finding ways to solve for it, you know, and things do happen. We've had our credit card reader go offline in the past. And in certain cases, you know, we've gone to a free vent situation where that's happened. In other cases, we start doing pay by phone and we ramp up our staff on our call center immediately when that, you know, and we have early detection systems. So it's really around making sure that you protect that driver experience, irrespective of whatever component failed in that value chain.
Do you feel like there's like a little extra pressure on you since you're trying to build a brand that people haven't heard of before, right? Like they've heard of Tesla superchargers, they've heard of Electrify America. Like if you want Ionna to be the default charging station and people show up and like the first time they do it, they have a bad time, like that reflects extra poorly, right?
Oh, trust me, we feel the pressure, you know. We feel the weight of the world on our shoulders, honestly, because we're a new player.
Yeah. Right?
Like we're not, it's not a new concept to build a national network of charging stations. We recognize that. But what we're trying to do is new. And so we definitely feel that burden of, hey, there is zero room for, you know, there's zero margin for error here. We better get it right. There's no excuses. And I think that's even not just in terms of how we operate the network, but even how fast we're trying to go in terms of getting sites live, right? How do we make sure we get sites live? In some cases, you know, we're actually doing, we'll work with the utilities to actually do some of their portion of the construction side. We'll actually construct the primary side of the where the utility would normally do just to go faster, right? So we definitely feel that burden of making sure that we can deliver this quality at scale.
What does that mean? I wanted to ask about, you know, the pace of rollout and sort of what are the impediments to that. I know we hear a lot about utility hookups being something that charging providers are waiting on, just like literally getting the power to the site. Maybe like the chargers are even built, but there's just no power there yet. It sounds like you have some like interesting solutions to that. What does it mean to be building, to help the utility build that out?
Yeah, and look, I think we've got a couple sites too where we're still working utilities that are, to your point, they're fully built and we're still working through the process. But I think we've done in general on the whole, you know, we've been able to move fast just from where we are today and where we started. And we kind of, there's a few ways that we do this, right? We try to treat the utilities as partners in this space. And we made our second year press release announcement of kind of our progress. We highlighted some of the utilities that moved at, we call Ionna speed, to get these sites up and running really fast. And there's examples of, you know, there's this infamous site we talk about internally, and it got a little bit of coverage in the news around Tucumcari, New Mexico, that we built that site in 6 days, like literally shovels in the ground, and 6 days later it was energized with Xcel Energy. They did an amazing job working with us to make that possible. And so what that looks like is, you know, we try to do a lot more planning up front before we even sign a site. We're bringing the utility in to say, hey, we're looking at a location either as a land purchase or a ground lease or a parking spot. Hey, is there capacity here? Or should we go somewhere else on the grid? So trying to work with them hand in hand. And then we'll look at, you know, what the obstacles are in terms of energizing a site. So, you know, can we do some of the construction work for the utility? Can we reduce the number of bays, charging bays, so we have, you know, because they have constraints on how much power they can bring to the sites. So we're constantly looking for creative solutions in terms of how we engage with utilities. And we do the same thing with, you know, with permitting as well, in terms of, hey, if a canopy is not allowed in a certain jurisdiction, we'll often put the canopy on pause. Maybe we'll come back in a second round and permit it later, because we want to make sure we're biasing towards getting the best customer experience at scale for drivers. And that sometimes means you know, making the decisions that's going to get the charging site live as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like those processes, like in general, not just with Ionna, but do you feel like in general, the permitting and the utility hookups, like has this stuff gotten like a little bit faster and smoother over the years, that now that like they're kind of all used to working with charging, or is it kind of the same deal as always?
No, I think it's definitely gotten better. I think a lot of utilities have, you know, EV charging specific teams out there. You know, I think post-COVID, you know, supply chain issues aren't as big of a deal anymore in terms of actual transformers, which was a real big hang-up, you know, back in the early part of the decade during COVID or during right after COVID. So I definitely you can definitely see how things have gotten better. But look, you're still building large sites with, you know, large, you know, huge energy density. If you think about it, right, we're talking about 2 megawatts worth of power in 10 parking stalls. I mean, that's a lot of power you're putting in a small space. And so, you know, and usually when you think about that much power, you're talking about a development cycle that's way longer, right? There's a lot of, could be a year of entitlements and planning and zoning and then permitting and coordination. And we're trying to sign a site and go live within the same year, whenever possible, right? So our timelines are just way more compressed. And I think that's what stresses the system, so to speak, that we try to work with these partners or utilities and permitting offices to see how we can be creative and go faster.
Yeah, that's the thing that it's interesting to think about is, like, people are always asking, like, why is it, you know, why are the utilities not ready? Like, why isn't it faster? And it's, I think it's because of what you said, which is like the, you know, normally for whatever it is, a few megawatts of power, you're talking about like a small industrial site or an office building or something like that, that's like not ready to be just built. Like, you just put chargers in the ground. It's like years of construction, and then maybe you need the power, right?
Exactly.
And with charging, it's, you need the power. Like, that's the whole game. You need it immediately.
Yeah, is exactly what it is, right? So it's just in this world of charging, we're moving at this much more compressed timeline, and that's what kind of, I'd say, puts stress or pressure really into the system that way.
Right. And so, like, the EV industry is in a weird place right now. You know, new EV sales are way down. We have a lot of companies canceling projects, delaying projects, including some of the backers of Ayana. How do you see this current moment in EVs as, you know, both like a charging provider and as somebody who's working really closely with the automakers?
Yeah, look, it's definitely, the macro environment has definitely, or macro conditions has definitely changed. There's no doubt, right? But here's the thing: is the future is not going to not have electric in it. We know, I think everyone knows that. That's a foregone conclusion. There's almost 6 million cars on the road in the U.S. today that are fully electric, and those cars are not going to go away. They're on the road right now, and you're seeing, you know, vehicles coming off lease now that are entering the secondary market. That's going to open up a whole new part of the market. So,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of reports out there of EV penetration settling at least this year, probably in the 6% range. Which tells you there's probably another, you know, at least 1 million cars that are gonna get sold in 2026 to add to the already 5.5, 6 million, you know, units in operation, vehicles on the road. So there's a big enough car park today and not enough charging, or excuse me, quality charging to go serve that need. So that's what we're trying to do, is solve the need today, but also make sure that as more vehicles come on the road and there's new products being launched, you know, some of our investors and other vehicle manufacturers have talked about new cars are launching, right? That's going to only help continue the adoption rate. So we definitely see electrification part of the equation. How much? Time will tell. But again, there's a need today for charging that we're trying to solve. And we know that what we're doing now will also solve the need in the future as it continues to proliferate.
Yeah. And so has the environment changed your plans at all? Is it like, you know, you deploy a little bit slower because the cars aren't coming on the road as quickly, or you deploy, you know, you kind of shift resources toward California and Texas and Florida and New York, where like there's a lot more EVs already being sold? Or does it not affect you at all?
I mean, right now it hasn't had any impact. You know, we've not been looking for, you know, public funding to build up the network, right? We've got a plan in front of us. And I think the big thing is kind of that key word, is we need to build a network, right? You can't become a boutique charging company in a city. You know, people it's very analogous to the cellular model, right? You want to build, you know, cell towers across the country so that, you know, you can get, no matter where you are, you can be able to get the coverage that you need. And that's really what we're trying to focus on, is that type of coverage, which you have to do in terms of building out nationally. That's that national footprint that we're focused on. So no change to our existing plan or strategy. We just need to make sure that we're continuing to build this quality at scale for customers, that, again, we can become a network they rely on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, it's not the model is to be there for everybody, not to be there in LA, for exactly for those people, right?
100%. Yep. 100%.
Yeah, and so what is it like working with a bunch of car manufacturers as investors? Are there competing interests that you have to balance? Do you work mostly like autonomously? I know you have like a board that, you know, is made up of reps from a bunch of these companies. How much input do they have in sort of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a great experience, honestly, working with the OEMs as partners in this space. So look, I think, you know, I tell them all the time in our board meetings, right? Like, look, at the end of the day, we're building supply and they're delivering the demand. I mean, it's a pretty easy algebraic equation that we're both working on together. And so that's what I think makes this thing special and unique. And again, you know, this isn't a venture backed organization. We're not a private equity firm. You know, our private equity firm isn't backing us. This is a strategic joint venture. And that means it needs to be strategic between us and the 8 automotive manufacturers to really build up the network that becomes the network for their drivers, right? And so, you know, you'll continue to see us drive integration as we scale to provide that benefit to their existing drivers, but also the prospective drivers that will come on, right? So, you know, we announced discounts and programs with our investors. GM was the first one to launch back in March. Others will follow suit in the next couple of months. But again, that's just step one in a long-term journey in terms of the step, you know, build out the network, drive discounts, drive further integration into the vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do they see it as, you know, a cost center? Is it a cost of selling more cars? Or do they see this as, in the future, being, you know, a real profit driver for these companies and for IANA?
IANA needs to be a sustainable business. Financially, right? And I think if it's not, then I think we've got a problem in terms of when you think about electrification and you think about infrastructure. So, you know, that's definitely something that's top of mind about how we build this company efficiently at scale, very much in the decisions that we make and how we think about our long-term strategic vision for the organization. So we're very much trying to make sure that there's a path here for, you know, to be financially independent and stable as we scale the business.
Right. That makes sense. Maybe we already touched on it with the sort of utility stuff. But what is the biggest challenge you have faced or are facing in rolling out the number of chargers you want to at the speed that you want to?
Yeah, I mean, we touched a little bit upon it, right? In terms of, I mean, anytime you're building construction, right, there's always stuff that comes up, and now you're trying to do it across multiple states at the same time as fast as possible. Look, I think the big thing though too is like what we strive for is we always want to be learning and driving continuous improvement, right? Because you've got, you know, 60% of the right answers, but there's a lot of learning to get the rest of the 40% there. And even the assumptions that you have may be wrong, right? You got to go out there and test them and then pivot as you go. So it's important that as we get these sites turned on, as we engage with drivers and engage with customers, launch different programs into the market, that we're gathering as much data and intelligence to then cycle that back in to our future deployments as well, right? So you obviously run the risk, if you go too fast, you may not be able to do that. So we're constantly driving the organization in a way that we're able to kind of collect different data and inputs from drivers into the system to try to make quick pivots over time.
Mm-hmm. And how is it going so far in terms of people recognizing that you're there and, you know, showing up? Like, is utilization, where is utilization? Is it where you want it to be? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think obviously one of the challenges you have as a new company, irrespective of any company, is how do you go build a brand, right? And go build a following and build awareness in the marketplace and do it in a way where you can acquire customers at a cost-efficient pace. I think we're pretty pleased with where we are in terms of that growth already. A lot of the, if you think about it, most people today are trying to find chargers through, you know, digital integrations, whether that's mapping services in the vehicle or Google or a multitude of different apps, right? So we've done a lot of work there. We're also doing a lot now in terms of out-of-home advertising, so billboards, you know, kind of with our brand about kind of a more of a retro vibe. So we've got billboards now across the country in partnership with some of our site host partners, so Wawa, Casey's, Sheetz, others, to leverage their brand and ours and the partnership that brings together. So doing a lot right now to engage with drivers. And then, you know, one of the things that I'm really proud of is the work that we've done to bring drivers to our site. So, you know monthly events at our locations to kind of open the door, so to speak, engage with drivers. This was something that we piloted back, going back to that learning environment. we piloted this back on our second year anniversary, where the whole network was at 20 cents, in some cases free for some of our locations. And we had a significant uptick. I think we had a 2x increase in volume that weekend from folks coming and trying us out. And we've seen these people come back after that. So we use that now as a kind of a quick turn to say, you know, this was successful. Let's roll this out on a monthly basis, right? So we're targeting roughly 8 new events every month, last Saturday of the month, partnering with local, you know, EV communities, EV drivers, social media influencers, et cetera, to really, we call them the station hand programs, where they can come out, engage with the local community, build awareness, answer questions, et cetera.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, giving people like 20 cent charging or free charging does sound like a good,
it's a great way to pull them in.
Strategy.
Yeah. But that goes back, I mean, it goes back to those three pillars I told you about before, right? Which was, hey, quality, charging quality, customer experience, and then best value. And so because of how we've been able to run the business efficiently, that allows us to kind of put that at the next gear where you say, hey, you know what, we're going to do 20 cents a kilowatt hour for a special holiday promotion or for an event, right? To be able to say, hey, come out and try us, see how you like it.
Yeah. How are you thinking about charging speed and power? You know, BYD released some pretty impressive stuff a little while ago, charging it over a megawatt. Cars that do 10 to nearly 100% in like 10 minutes, just like absolutely insane stuff that we don't have the cars here yet. You have other companies that are other charging, you know, hardware players that are building 500 kilowatt, 600 kilowatt. I believe Ionna's all at 400.
Correct.
Do you think about the future? Yeah, today. So how do you think about future proofing? Obviously right now, like 400 is plenty for virtually every vehicle sold in America. But do you think about what's next and, you know, where that might go?
Oh, for sure we do, right? I think that goes back to that strategic nature of the JV, the joint venture with the OEMs, where we can work with them in terms of, hey, what do they have coming down the line from a product roadmap perspective to make sure that we can serve future vehicles. And I think, you know, it's the kind that it takes two to tango, so to speak, right? So we can put in our high power charging we want, the vehicles have to be there to accept it. So, you know, we feel pretty good about where we are today at 400 kilowatts, both in terms of the dwell time, the customer experience someone will have, and then in terms of the vehicles that we can serve. And to your point, basically, 99.9%, we can get to the top end of that curve for them. So we don't see an issue right now, but it's something we're constantly evaluating, right? If, as the market starts to shift, we want to be where the market's going, not try to catch up later. And, you know, would it be surprising if, you know, a year from now, we're not installing higher power charging beyond what we've already installed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think, you know, right now 400 is the standard, that's what all your stations are at. It's feasible in a year or two, it's going to be 500 being the standard. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I don't know if I have an answer for you right now, but exact power a year or two from now. But I'll tell you, we are evaluating higher power, right? I think it's just a question of timing of, you know, when does it make sense to go make those changes and at which sites and which parts of the country, or what type of sites, right? Are they corridor sites? Do we do them in just metro sites? And how much more are we talking about, right? You know, 50 kilowatts isn't incrementally going to make a difference probably. But do you go higher or not? And I think there's a lot that scope we're going into to really evaluate this. And that goes back to that learning piece, right? We can see how long people are staying. We can see what the charging speeds are, right? Okay, how do we want to learn from that?
Yeah, so what is the different consideration then between metro and corridor? Because I guess, like, instinctively you'd think, okay, people are on the highway. That's probably when they want the fastest charge.
Right.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's the people in the maybe it's the Uber drivers in the metro area. I don't know. How do you think about the differences?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, that's why we go out there and survey customers. And I think we're still learning in terms of some of the customer behavior and some of the inputs of what really matters. But yeah, I mean, you know, our investment right now is focused, you know, 70% roughly is focused inside of cities. 30% is pure corridors. And then even when we're inside of a city, we're trying to make sure that we're as close to a highway as possible to we call stack use cases and get different folks out to our site. So, you know, I think that's kind of the key thing is, you know, in the day, it all comes down to dwell time, right? How long is someone willing to sit there? And then does that match up with the amenity on site? And that really will then dictate, assuming the car can take it, what power levels that you want to put in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one other kind of future technology thing I wanted to ask about, or I mean, it's current, but it's, I think, growing is battery-backed charging. Like, we're seeing more and more stations that you know, to reduce the burden on the grid, to maybe build out faster, get the power there, get more power at a site faster. You're seeing stationary storage implement on site. Is that something you're exploring as well?
Yeah, we definitely are. I mean, you know, early on we looked at, hey, do we put batteries in place early on to mitigate demand charges? Does it help with interconnection timelines, et cetera? And we took a stance early on of, again, going back to, we want to make sure we were fast to market to get sites live. Some of the stuff can become a distraction very quickly from an interconnection standpoint, permitting, et cetera, right? Even construction. So we said, hey, listen, let's not do that now, but let's come back to it when it makes sense, right? So again, going back to that learning piece, now we can go back and see, hey, okay, which of our sites have we, do we have really expensive rate tariffs where our demand charges are very high that we should go back and put batteries, right? So that's something that, you know, honestly, it's probably not even a this year topic. It's probably a next year and beyond, just in terms of prioritization of charging quality, customer experience, best value in the marketplace.
Right, right. Because that's the, that's more of a benefit to, that's a behind the scenes benefit to you guys to get the energy a little bit cheaper, not necessarily something that the customer sees.
Exactly. And I've said, I've said this before to other folks that I've talked to, right? Like we have these cultural tenets. Not the first one in our company is safety. Everything we do has to be, you know, we have consumers every day touching our chargers. These are, you know, these are high powered chargers. We have, you know, active construction sites right now across 50 different locations in the United States. We've got maintenance techs going to, you know, over 100 sites. So safety is number one, everything we do. But the second most important thing that we do behind that, right behind that, is drivers, because we need drivers first, right? So I want to make sure that the stuff we're working on is going to impact the drivers. There's stuff that's going to help us on the bottom line, sure. But if I get the top line working right, because I'm providing the best value in the marketplace for a driver and taking care of them, it'll, everything else will work itself out over time.
All right. I think that's a great place to leave it. Seth Cutler is the CEO of Ayana. Thanks so much for joining today. This was a great conversation.
Thanks, Tim. It's great being here.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Now it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world this week. Mac, who you got?
All right, I got a minus. I think I've done like pluses the last like four times, and I'm gonna bring some hater energy here. But Mazda announced that it was rolling back its EV ambitions, and I know what you're thinking. What EV ambitions? The company has only launched one EV in the United States so far, the ill-fated short-range MX-30, which came out around 2021 and did not last very long. And they have been planning to do a, you know, full, true ground-up EV architecture with a much longer range, a much more competitive product. It's already been delayed before. They just delayed it another 2 years, saying it will now come at the soonest in 2029. But, you know, everyone's delaying EVs. I get that. The reason this is my minus is that in the announcement, they said, hey, great. Unlike a lot of our competitors, we're not going to have to take these multi-billion dollar write downs on, you know, fixed infrastructure investments we've made, because we haven't made any of those investments yet. We haven't actually done any of the work. And so this car that was supposedly going to launch sometime around next year, like, okay, so they didn't have any supplier contracts that couldn't be reversed. They didn't have, you know, any real work done on the factory to get it. It's just, they literally said, like, we basically stopped before we started on this, which is why they're like, oh, we've always been cautious on this. And they describe themselves as an intentional follower. And while I hate the development, I hate a company saying, like, we're going to stop work before we started, I think intentional follower is going to enter my lexicon forever. Like, if I laid on a project at work, I'm gonna be like, sorry boss, I've decided to be an intentional follower on this one.
But it's the opposite of discovering something before it was cool. I'm just right. I'm an intentional follower. No, I have no idea what band you're talking about. I'm just an intentional follower.
Yes. Not a great look.
I mean, it does end up, it's like, it's, you know, in the same vein as Toyota, which now is doing a lot more EV stuff, but it's like They financially, at least in the short term, seems to work out for Mazda. If they, you know, their pivot isn't actually a pivot at all,
right,
then then they don't lose any money on EVs. My plus this week is Tesla is beta testing supercharger wait lists, which is, I just think, a cool new feature. Like, we've all been to superchargers yep. where there's a line, like all of them are taken and there's people waiting. And now they're trying to kind of automate that where
yeah.
as you're pulling up to a charger, you can get added to the wait list and there's a line and then, you know, it tells you when you're next up. I think there's still a few question marks about how exactly this works. Like, if somebody else pulls into that stall, will it like not charge? Like, can you get cut in line?
Right.
I'm not super sure about that. I think that right now it's just kind of a suggestion to like
yeah.
wait in line for your turn. But clearly this makes a lot of sense and it's a cool innovation from the company that like always does the best little technology integrations with charging, just because they own everything.
Right.
They have so much, you know, control across the ecosystem.
It's also interesting for them because I think of the existing charging networks, they kind of have the least need for this, in that like it's very rare I pull up to a supercharger that's completely full, whereas True. You go to like a 4-stall Electrify America, I know how to manage that queue. I've had to do that before. But I am interested to see if someone develops. Yeah, it's interesting if you can do this all with software. I'm sort of the opinion, like, if there's not someone there actually enforcing it, like, it's basically a version of what we already have now, which is we vaguely keep track of who showed up in what order and, like, do your best. But having it actually in the app and signaled that way, I think could be really useful, and I hope it works.
Yeah, same. They are piloting this at 5 sites right now, 4 in California, 1 in New York. And I saw a lot of people on X who were amped about this. They were like, please bring this to my charger in, yeah. you know, New Jersey. So clearly this is something that you got to take the X posters with a grain of salt. But it yeah. makes sense that this is something people want if their local charger is always jammed up.
For sure.
Again, if you try this out, let us know how it works. Let us know if you like it. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show is produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.